Hey, Dr. B.
Hey, Luke.
You know, I feel like the older I get, the harder it is to kind of make friends in this city. Like, I'm trying to figure out how to connect with people, and I just don't feel like I know where to even start.
I feel like we hear that a lot, honestly. You can only drink so many beers and eat so many tacos in this town. People are wondering, how do I connect? How do I get to that place? Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about that.
We all go through junk, but we don't have to go through it alone. If you struggle with loneliness or discontentment or disconnection or anything, really, maybe you just need to talk to somebody. Check out Modern Therapy, a psychology practice here in Houston driven by one overarching mission: to cultivate a well-lived existence despite life's inherent challenges. Check out mymoderntherapy.com to make an appointment with Dr. Beatrice Craven or one of her associates, or give them a call at 281-783-9297 and tell them Luke sent you. Again, that's mymoderntherapy.com. From Milieu Media Group, this is The H, a podcast about the people and places that make Houston, Houston. I'm your host, Luke Brauner, and this is Season 3, Episode 8, A Heart for Houston, with Dr. Tom Nguyen. I was in my early 20s the first time I saw an episode of the Zach Braff slapstick comedy-slash-drama series Scrubs about a group of young doctors at an ambiguously located medical training hospital called Sacred Heart. And I'll be honest, I thought it was the dumbest show I'd ever seen. At least until a few years later when one of my best friends and bandmates convinced me to give it another shot. I did, despite my reservations, and he was right. Well, we both were. It was the dumbest show I'd ever seen, but that was part of its charm. It didn't take itself too seriously, and for that reason, it was actually able to capture some pretty poignant moments in the human experience. I binge-watched the first 5 or 6 seasons back in the days when binge-watching was a brand new concept and required the purchase of multiple DVD box sets until I'd eventually had all the ridiculousness I could handle. It was always a bit surprising to me when I'd read articles in which doctors, real doctors, claimed that Scrubs was probably the most accurate portrayal on television of the residency experience. I didn't even know training hospitals were a thing. Then, in the spring of 2019, I met Dr. Tom Nguyen.
My name is Tom Nguyen. I'm a cardiothoracic surgeon at Memorial Hermann. Essentially, I operate on people's hearts. My particular interest is operating on hearts the least invasive way possible, doing complex surgery, and with the goal of getting patients and loved ones back on their feet sooner than later. So that's my interest. I probably do 7 or 8 operations per week. I'm involved in medical school and do a lot of research as well. So we're a teaching center. We work with residents, fellows, and medical students, and we kind of train the future generation of doctors and surgeons here.
Although not exactly a Houston native, Tom has called Houston home for the majority of his life.
I'm somewhat of a Houston native. I'm an immigrant, and in some ways, kind of the classic immigrant story. I was born in Vietnam, came here when I was 1 year old as a political refugee, and my first language was Vietnamese, and I picked up English along the way, and eventually settled in Houston and called it home. I have to admit, I don't think I fully realized and appreciated Houston as my home until I had a chance to leave Houston, but it wasn't until when I was gone when I really kind of fully appreciated kind of how wonderful Houston is as a city and how special it is for me to call it home.
Tom and his older sister, Kim, were raised mostly by their dad, Michael.
As you can imagine, it was kind of tough times during that era with the end of the Vietnam War, and you know, my biological mother eventually left, and it was my dad who raised us. And I owe so much to him and who I am from him. He was a very high-ranking military official in Vietnam. He was an engineer, very successful, but when he came here with nothing, and literally with nothing on his back. And we came to Houston very poor. We lived in kind of the projects of Houston for a while. I remember growing up and really kind of eating rice and eggs and soy sauce, and that kind of was like our mainstay. And when we were eating, you know, we try to say, hey, don't eat too much meat because that's expensive. You know, kind of fill yourself up with rice. But I learned a lot from him, and you know, the kind of a lot of the perseverance and the work ethic and the determination. So he came here with nothing, and he worked at one point at Shipley's Donuts while he was working at, you know, as a welder. But eventually, you know, kind of got more training and education and worked as an engineer at one of the big oil companies here in Texas. Eventually retired doing that. but also was very, very active in the Vietnamese community. At one point, he was the president of the Vietnamese community. And that's kind of what I think instilled in me this sense of kind of ambition and working outside the box and just doing something a little, you know, more for your community. And I think that's where I got that from. But so he was eventually transitioned and was a professional and did engineering and then also kind of helped organize the Vietnamese community here in Houston. You know, in some ways, for me, kind of growing up, at least initially, without kind of a biological mother was tough. And in some ways, I hated it so much because, you know, my dad was kind of raising me and kind of these two immigrant kids in kind of a Texas city. But I think that hardship and those struggles is what kind of defined me and kind of developed some thick skin on me. And I think really kind of, you know, made me who I am today. I don't think that if that didn't happen, I'm not sure if I'd be where I'm at today, ironically enough. Although I'll look back and those were some of the tough times, the toughest times of our lives. We're very fortunate though. My dad remarried and my stepmother, I consider her my biological mother. She was phenomenal and wonderful. But there were some dark times during those periods that I remember very clearly.
Throughout those dark times, Tom learned a lot from his dad. But he didn't learn everything from his dad. He had a few non-traditional teachers in his early days as well.
My very first language was Vietnamese, and I grew up at home speaking Vietnamese. But kind of the classic story, I learned how to speak English by watching cartoons. And I remember waking up in the early mornings, and this is probably before the time, but really early in the morning, before the television really broadcast, it was like you turn on the TV and you see these kind of colored bars. We don't have that anymore because it's, you know, it plays all the time. But I'd wake up when those bars were showing until the cartoons would show up. As you can imagine, one of my favorite cartoons was Tom and Jerry. So when my parents became citizens, I was a naturalized citizen. And, you know, they were immigrants. So, you know, English was their second language. And eventually they spoke it very well. But at that time, they didn't. So they told me, hey, you know, choose an American name. So I chose Tom from Tom and Jerry. But you can imagine as a 3 or 4 year old kid, you don't realize that Tom is short for Thomas. They didn't realize that either. They just said, okay, we'll run with Tom. So on a lot of my formal documents and on my citizenship form, it's actually listed as Tom and not Thomas. And the funny thing is now that I'm a professional, a lot of times they require formal documents and people will write down Thomas, but I have to always change it, let them know that it's Tom. And the funny thing too is that, you know, a lot of times when I tell people this story, people obviously they think it's somewhat humorous, but they're glad I choose Jerry because I think Tom's kind of a cooler character in the cartoon. So,
what was your given name?
It was T-U-Y-E-N, Thuyen. So all my family members call me Thuyen, and you know, so that's my Vietnamese name.
Along with much of his family, Tom grew up just outside of Houston on the northwest side of town in the master plan subdivision of Copperfield, where he attended Cy Fair High School.
At the time, if you drive to Austin, Cy Fair High School was the last high school you saw until you just saw cornfields and really a lot of rural area. And now the area has completely exploded. But I remember at one point, I think Cy Fair had the largest future farmers of America in the state of Texas. So that was kind of the environment I grew up in. I grew up kind of this little Asian cowboy. You know, my first three cars were pickup trucks, and I grew up kind of learning how to two-step, and, you know, I love 80s and 90s country music, but that's kind of the little micro-environment that I grew up in and made a big imprint in who I am today.
After graduating from Cy Fair, Tom opted to stay local, matriculating at Rice University as an economics major.
You know, it's interesting. I always knew I wanted to do medicine. The nice thing is that to go to medical school, there aren't a whole lot of strict requirements. You know, folks think that you have to be a pre-med major. You know, I guess there's really no such thing as a pre-med major. You can major anything you want. You just need to take the classes required to apply to medical school, and the requirements are fairly basic. For me, I liked economics because it was kind of the social side of kind of human interaction. You know, econ, if you really boil down to it, it's kind of how people make decisions. And to me, I was very intrigued by that, one, from a kind of intellectual curiosity standpoint, but two, I think things that I can use and apply to medicine a little bit and not necessarily be the traditional biology major or chemistry major or whatnot. And I think ultimately it hasn't hurt me too much in my path. If anything, hopefully it's added a little more perspective to what I do.
What was your experience at Rice like?
It was phenomenal. You know, Rice's student body is relatively small at that time. Our class size was smaller than Cy Fair, was roughly about 600 students. And if you could imagine for a school like Rice, for 600 students, you need to have college athletes, you need to have musicians, you need to have academic scholars. So everyone you bumped into were so incredible and had done so much. And I have to admit, I wonder why I was there and how I got there. But it was phenomenal. You learn so much from all the people around you. It was very diverse in both culture and talent as well.
So when did you realize that you wanted to do medicine, and what was sort of the catalyst for that?
I think at a relatively early age, I'd probably say in high school and certainly kind of entering college for sure. I think medicine is so special, and I'm obviously very, very biased, but I think most folks inherently want to do medicine, and probably I would add another level to it, want to do surgery. Again, this is very kind of biased, but let me frame it for you. You know, as a doctor, you get a chance to help people. You get the chance to use science. But it's more than that, because you develop relationships with patients, right? So, you know, if you were to come to my office, we would sit down and you would tell me things that, you know, you probably just tell your spouse or your significant other. And then I do an exam on you, and I can see parts of your body that no one else has seen before, all with the intent of helping you and making you feel better. And that's a relationship, the doctor-patient relationship that you get, that's very special. I mean, there are few professions that really are that intimate, right, that you're trusting someone else, let alone when you're doing surgery, you know, we're operating and taking things out and putting it back together again that you haven't even seen before, right? And that's what kind of has drawn me to surgery. But, you know, kind of heart surgery is even another level, right? Because when we do heart surgery, you know, we'll stop your heart. Do you mind me asking how old you are?
I'm 39.
You're 39. So for the past 39 years, since you were born, even before that, your heart's been beating. So we work with med students all the time. And I tell them, you know, this patient, most patients you operate on, are older, they're in their 80s. And I tell them, for the past 80 years, the patient's heart's been beating, but we're going to stop the patient's heart. And in some ways, that heartbeat defines life, right? For 39 years, you know, when your parents saw that heartbeat on the ultrasound, they're like, you know, we have a son. And for the first time in the past 39 years, we're going to stop that heart. But on top of that, when we do heart surgery, we're fixing, you know, people's hearts with very delicate techniques. You know, some of the sutures we use is finer than, you know, our hair follicle. You know, we use, obviously, magnifying glasses. So I was really lucky. There's a program at the Texas Heart Institute where they had college students volunteer and work and watch surgery at St. Luke's Texas Heart. So that was my first exposure, and I fell in love with heart surgery. I know I wanted to become a heart surgeon. I had a little man crush on Denton Cooley and read all the books about Denton Cooley, and Denton Cooley went to Hopkins for medical school. I knew I wanted to go to Hopkins for medical school. And so that's kind of what drew me into medicine and into surgery and even heart surgery.
But before you could really start thinking about medical school, there were still lessons to learn at Rice.
So I think what Rice taught me was kind of the ability to fail and to kind of get back on your feet. And this sounds really somewhat trite, but it's something I believe in so much. And I really do, to a certain extent, believe that you're kind of defined by how you react to failure. So you can imagine Rice, most of the students there are valedictorians and salutatorians. I wasn't. Most have these phenomenal SAT scores. My SAT score is okay, but certainly not in the perfect range by any means. So it's intimidating. You got a lot of smart people there, and it can be a struggle. But what it taught me was kind of how to respond when you don't do well, how to get back on your feet, and how to be resilient and really kind of chase dreams a little bit. And I think probably at Rice is when things started to open up a little bit, and kind of my eyes started to open up, and I really started to become kind of a dream chaser and kind of be very ambitious with a lot of things that I wanted, kind of think outside the box. But I think it allowed me to, you know, learn how to get around setbacks, but also to kind of pursue dreams a little bit.
At some point during his time as a Rice undergrad, Tom received a word of advice that's affected the entire course of his life since.
One of the best advice that anyone has really given me is that you're not a championship team unless you win away from home. And I think a lot of folks in Texas tend to stay in Texas, and, you know, there's no reason not to. There are great schools here, and there are a lot of kind of cool things to do here. But it wasn't until I left college and started additional training around the country was when my eyes really started to open.
Upon graduating from Rice in 1996, fueled by a newfound ambition and desire to chase down his dreams, Tom began pursuing the path that he believed would enable him to help the most people possible.
I had these aspirations of becoming Surgeon General. You know, I was younger, and C. Everett Koop was there and had this huge, you know, smoking cessation campaign. And I thought that would be incredibly impactful. So I had this goal of becoming Surgeon General. And I thought the best place to kind of get a good experience would be at the World Health Organization in Geneva, Switzerland. So I was able to get an internship in Geneva and live there and do research and work on health policy, but not just kind of local policy, international health policy. So that's when the changing point happened, right? You know, because before then, I was this kind of Asian Texas kid who never really left the Houston city limits, and I'm thrown into Geneva, where 4 out of 5 people are not from Geneva. You know, the average person speaks 4 languages. Working at the WHO, the World Health Organization, where they're concerned about not health within a block or community, but globally around the world. It was a phenomenal experience. Well, what was actually really interesting too was being there. Again, I don't have a lot of money, so I was living in kind of, it wasn't really a hostel, but it was a complex where there were people from everywhere kind of working for all these United Nations organizations. And you can imagine there are people from Pakistan and a lot of kind of Middle Eastern countries. Again, growing up in Texas, I have to admit, initially I was very reserved and cautious. But what I realized was at the end of the day, they were just people as well, right? And I think people miss that. And I think I was very colored by my environment, but it wasn't until I left my environment and lived somewhere else where I realized that, yeah, we might have political differences and whatnot, but at the end of the day, they're people and they want to just take care of their loved ones and take care of their country and have, you know, different loves and passions just as we do. And they're not bad people. You know, some of the folks there are the ones that would feed me when I didn't have food there and share their food with me. So it was a great opportunity to develop some kind of lasting friendships.
So when you were at Rice, you mentioned you sort of learned to be more of a dream chaser. Is that the dream, the Surgeon General?
So at that time, I think that was one of the dreams. But the dream was, I think, ultimately, what I want to do is just do something that's impactful and affect people's lives. And my thought was that, you know, being involved in public health and public policy gave you an opportunity to affect a lot of people. So that was the initial kind of dream. But ultimately, I think one of the dreams that I have is really to do something very impactful. It sounds really cheesy to say, but you know, I do strive to leave this world a little bit better place than before I entered. I try to better myself every year. And I feel like if you're not, you know, doing something to better yourself, then you're not progressing. And I think it's important for individuals, but also as a society, to continually to push yourself to progress, right? So whatever that might be, you know, I might decide, okay, this year I'm going to work really hard about, you know, getting in shape and doing a marathon. Or this year I'm going to work really hard about being transparent and honest with myself and when I look at the mirror and understanding, you know, who's in the mirror or developing better relationships. But it has to be something. You know, I think it's important to, as a species, as individuals, to just do things that just make yourself better, right? Otherwise, we're just stagnant.
So following his time in Geneva, he made his way to urban Baltimore, Maryland, to attend medical school at the renowned Johns Hopkins University.
You know, again, imagine, you know, from the suburbs of Northwest Houston to Geneva, Switzerland, then after that to, you know, kind of urban Baltimore. You know, at the time, Baltimore was a tough city, you know, and very crime-ridden. They had, I think, one of the highest syphilis rates in the country for the longest time. You know, Johns Hopkins is in East Baltimore, where from my dorm room, I would routinely hear kind of gunshots in the distance. It was tough, you know, a lot of learning, but it was tough. You know, it's hard to cram so much knowledge and information within such a short amount of time. But it was good. I experienced my very first NOAA medical school, you know, I had a chance to see my very first kind of cadaver and operate on a body in medical school. It was good, but it was definitely very challenging, for sure.
Tom finished medical school at Johns Hopkins University in 2002, but his journey was far from over.
Medical school is 4 years. At the end of medical school, you decide on a specialty. And to do that specialty, you apply to what's called a residency. So you need to decide what residency you want to do. I knew I wanted to do cardiothoracic surgery. And the next step for residency, at least at that time, was a residency in general surgery. So during medical school, I worked my way towards getting a residency in general surgery.
And once again, the advice he'd received about how you're not a champion team unless you can win away from home came into play.
You know, Johns Hopkins, you know, at the time, it still is a phenomenal hospital with a phenomenal surgery residency program. But again, I wanted to broaden my horizon a little bit. And I had the option of staying at Johns Hopkins. But Hopkins is a very conservative, traditional program. And what I wanted to do was go to a place that was very opposite from that, but also a strong program. And there's no better place than Stanford. So I traveled across the country to Stanford to do my general surgery training. So you can imagine, just kind of give you some perspective. And you can imagine this, you know, it makes sense. The East Coast is, you know, again, you know, a little more conservative in their thought process, a lot of traditional, a lot of history. And the West Coast is traditionally a lot more progressive. So even in the general surgery training, the training was very progressive, a lot less reliant on these kind of traditions and whatnot. So for example, at Hopkins, you know, every Friday people would wear a certain tie, an Osler tie or whatnot. And when you see patients, you would see them in really a tie and kind of very formal. At Stanford, you kind of go and see them in scrubs and just whatever it takes.
So in 2010, after 4 years of undergrad at Rice, 4 years of medical school at Johns Hopkins University, and 8 years as a general surgery resident at Stanford, a part of the process on which most folks only spend 5 years, Tom continued on the path towards becoming a heart surgeon specifically and headed back to the East Coast to begin a 2-year fellowship at Columbia University in New York City.
At the time, Columbia had, I think, and it still does, one of the best cardiothoracic surgery training programs in the country.
And what was that like?
It was tough. You know, I think you always have this vision of, hey, I want to become a heart surgeon, but you're not sure if you could really do it, right? And you can imagine up until then, I've invested all those years thinking, hey, I want to become a heart surgeon. But what if you get there and you realize that you have a really bad tremor? Or what if you pass out when you see blood? Or what if you can't think quickly enough on your feet? Or what if you get emotional during these decision-making processes? Or what if you can't detach yourself? Or what if you don't have the stamina? You know, some of our operations are, you know, we're routine in my operation of 4 or 5 hours, but, you know, sometimes we do a lung transplant and, you know, sometimes you're there for like 10, 12 hours just standing and operating and without lack of sleep, you know. Anyway, I wasn't sure. I wanted to become a heart surgeon, but I have to admit, I really wasn't sure if I could actually do it. And I probably would say that probably midway through is when I realized, like, wow, you know, I actually can become a heart surgeon. But it was tough. That aspect of it was very tough.
And as if the demands of his fellowship weren't tough enough, life became even more difficult in October of that year.
We had just got done doing a heart transplant. We're driving back with a fresh heart to New York Columbia Presbyterian. And we're in these ambulances so we can kind of cut through traffic and whatnot. And one of the students next to me said, it started snowing. And she said, oh, it's starting to snow. Make a wish. This, you know, now's your time to make a wish on the first snow of the season. And my wish at the time was something so simple. It was like, I just want to sleep. I'm just so tired. I just want to sleep. So I came back home and eventually we dropped the heart off and I kind of crawled back home. And so I was looking forward to just, you know, getting some sleep and then going to some Halloween parties, right? And having some fun. And then I was woken up suddenly by a phone call from my sister. And she told me that my dad was found down and the ambulance was coming. So I kind of started to make plans. And then the next phone call I got was that he passed away. And I broke down. I found out, you know, probably around 7 or 8 p.m. And I got the next flight out, which was like 4 or 5 in the morning. Kind of as a background story about my dad, you know, kind of very traditional Asian son relationship. You know, I guess Asians, older generation Asians, aren't necessarily that personable or personal even, but the love is there. So, you know, we never had, like, my dad and I never had this personal relationship. We never hugged each other. You know, I have to admit, I never hugged my dad. I never had a chance to tell him I love him. And that's just, I think, a part of culture, and it's unfortunate. And probably what makes me the most sad is that, one, you know, I never had a chance to kind of really tell him I love him, how much of an inspiration he was, how much he defined me, who I am today. And probably the other aspect of it, too, is, you know, he really didn't get a chance to kind of see how I ended up and where I am now. And I think he would be proud, but, you know, that makes me a little bit sad.
What do you feel like you learned or how were you shaped by his passing?
You know, I think in some ways to just take full advantage and appreciate the relationships you have because you don't know what's kind of around the corner. You know, from the get-go, you know, we didn't have that close of a relationship, but I think that for me, it's very important to have a more personal relationship with my children and to hug them and tell them I love them and be more physically there for him. He was there, you know, and we knew he was there, but, you know, kind of very typical Asian man, male culture at that time. I don't think it's that way as much anymore, but it was very kind of removed process. And I think for me, it's important to do that. I think another aspect is to kind of carry on his legacy a little bit and kind of make him proud with the things that we do. So that's one of the reasons why I started gravitating back to Houston, you know, because he was here and You know, again, our home is in Cyprus, up in Copperfield, and that made me realize, like, hey, Houston's my home. I need to come back here because this is where all my family is. You know, I have my immediate family. He came here with absolutely nothing and sponsored all my aunts and uncles to come to Houston. We lived in this tiny house, and I remember growing up actually sleeping on a couch when I was, like, I don't know, probably most of elementary school, because all the other rooms, it was like a little refugee camp in Cyprus, but all the other rooms were taken by my aunts and uncles. But that's kind of what he was. He brought folks in and he sponsored them and really kind of helped a lot of people.
So Tom set his sights on Houston, but his path back after so many years away, living all over the country, was anything but direct.
This is where I've always believed it's important to think outside the box and approach life like a chess match, right? People don't win chess matches by thinking one step ahead. You think two or three steps ahead and have contingency plans in the process, and you think kind of into the future. I knew the future of heart surgery was not necessarily kind of these big open surgeries where it takes folks 6 to 7 weeks to recover from. I knew the future of it was a lot of minimally invasive transcatheter techniques. So knowing that, and at that time, I was very lucky, there was this emerging technology called transcatheter aortic valve replacement, which I knew was going to make a huge impact in our field, and which it has. It's called TAVR. If that's a term that you haven't heard of, you definitely will hear of it, or sometimes people call it TAVI. It's a way to replace a aortic valve that has become tight, and it's phenomenal. Using the chess analogy, that I always was trying to think a couple steps ahead, and I didn't want to do what was the status quo. Again, you know, if you're doing the same thing, then how are you differentiating yourself from others and how are you progressing? And I wanted to do something that was new and novel. So instead of doing heart surgery by cracking the chest, I knew that other folks out there were doing heart surgery through small incisions between the ribs and getting phenomenal results, and the patients do very well. I also knew that this was new technology called transcatheter aortic valve replacement that is admittedly mostly done by cardiologists. It's another specialty, but it's something that surgeons, I think, should be involved with and can do. They just need the experience and exposure to do that. At the time, I had finished training, but I hadn't started really working just yet. So it was a little easier for me to take an additional year of training to pick up this additional skill set that I think would really help me a lot in the end, and I think it has. So after finishing training at Columbia in New York City, I went to Emory in Atlanta to do even more training in a lot of transcatheter techniques. So I guess I'm one of the few surgeons out there that can replace valves both through tiny incisions, probably the width of your finger, a 1 centimeter incision that goes through your groin and replaces your valve, or I can do open heart surgery through kind of a 4 or 5 centimeter incision in your chest, or I could do complex open surgery. So that I knew that was how I wanted to shape my career, and I try to shape my experiences and get the experiences accordingly to be able to do so. So I think that's what ultimately has allowed me to differentiate myself a little bit. But I look at it differently. It's less about differentiation. I think it's more about patient care because of that, when someone comes in, I'm not biased by whatever tools, by a hammer per se. I have a lot more tools in my toolbox, right? So I'm not biased that if I can only do TAVR, every patient looks like a TAVR patient for me. You know, if I only do open heart surgery by cracking people's chest, everyone's going to get their chest cracked open, or the minimally invasive approach. You know, I think having some kind of facility in doing all that, you can very objectively decide what's best for your patient. And that's kind of the way I look at it and what I really believe in, right? I definitely see that. No, it's inherent, right? If you're only doing one thing, then you're going to be very biased to just only do that for every patient. But I think, you know, depending on the situation, some techniques are better than others. So I spent a full year at Emory doing that. And then after that, I came back to Houston.
Not too long after coming back to be closer to family, he met the woman who would become his wife, Gina.
We lived in the same building and I saw her in the elevator and she was kind of cute. But you really can't start too much of a conversation in the elevator. You have like 10 seconds to say something, and I would just hope that I cross paths with her again. I eventually did, and the rest is history. So
he and Gina married in July of 2017. And within the first year or so of their marriage, they welcomed a daughter, Amelia, into the world. And his already large family grew just a little more.
My wife is a radiology resident. She's going to go into interventional radiology at MD Anderson. And she's phenomenal and keeps me on my feet and challenges me and, you know, is my rock. I have a younger brother who runs the organization that my dad built. It's this huge kind of nonprofit organization for immigrants, providing services for them and providing housing for a lot of Vietnamese immigrants across the city. My mom is retired, but she worked as a pharmacist. My stepmother, I call her my mom, she worked as a pharmacist. My sister is a nurse in Cyprus. And we have about 8 or 9 aunts and uncles with, you know, kids. So every time we have a, you know, family event, it's a lot of folks there.
I was curious. After spending so many years pursuing his ambition wherever it led him, Switzerland, Baltimore, Stanford, New York City, Atlanta, what it was like returning to Houston, where he started, and where his ambition was focused moving forward.
From a professional standpoint, what I would like to continue to do is build our Valve Center and be the best center in the country, really. And I think we have all the resources to do that. We have a great multidisciplinary team, and we have a lot of support. And that's my goal, to be kind of, at the very least, the top program here in Houston, but recognize across the country. And I think we're heading in that direction. We are a very busy TAVR program. We've done probably about 2,500 implants or so. But more importantly, we're doing this in people who are very, 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 very sick. In the past, we wouldn't have operated on. So if someone comes in their mid-80s, and we don't even blink an eye. We do a TAVR on them, and they do fine. They go home, you know, within a couple of days. And that's what's so cool about medicine. It's progressed so much where we're able to do these things on really sick folks and get them back on their feet and do it minimally invasively, and they actually do very well. Folks, again, come in from all sorts of places to either have surgery or to come watch and learn our techniques. So that's one aspect of it. The other passion of mine is training residents and fellows. And I realize that the way we currently train has been very traditional. And I'm on this mission to better educate our residents and fellows so that they are able to take a path somewhat similar to mine and develop these skill sets. So we're working with a lot of the educational societies and organizations to try to change the pathways a little bit. On a personal level, I would love to have another child and have a family. I realize that, I guess at the end of the day, you know, you might have all these awards and accolades and stuff hanging on your walls, but really what is your legacy is kind of the family, your family first and then friends. But, you know, I'd love to have a bigger family for sure. Obviously, I started a little bit late, but love to have a bigger family and in that process, you know, raise my kids in the best way possible so they're productive and happy and thrive.
Another thing that Tom mentioned caring deeply about was carrying on his father's legacy, both in the work that he does and in the way that he cares for his family.
I think professionally, what he taught me is whatever you do, just be the best you can. If you're a janitor, just be the best mopper you can be, right? If you're a barista, you know, make the best coffee that you can. And for me, you know, caring professionally is just being the absolute best physician and doctor and surgeon that I can be, I can strive to be. Obviously, you know, it's a growing process and you can always become better. And that's something I'm actively always working on, for sure. From a personal standpoint, again, I think the most unique attribute that he taught me is just persistence and being creative and thinking outside the box and progressing yourself. This is kind of bad, but I feel like if I'm not being productive, I feel like I'm kind of a bad person or something. You know, I feel like I need to always do something and be productive. I hardly ever watch TV, and you know, when I come home, I'm always trying to be active and doing something productive. I want to make sure at the end of the night, I've done something, right? I don't want to look back at the day and say, what did I do today? You know, I want to say, hey, okay, well, today I did these things. And sometimes it's, you know, write a paper, you know, sometimes it's prepare a presentation or whatnot. But, you know, just being productive. I think that's from a personal level. I think he would be proud of that.
One of the things I realized while listening to Tom's story is that I've always held this assumption that doctors, and surgeons especially, got into medicine for their own benefit. Whether it be a love of money or recognition, a need to feel superior to others, or simply a need to feel needed. What else could possibly motivate a person to endure so many years of school and all the debt that comes with school? Or to postpone starting a family or even having a social life? Or to forfeit the freedom that comes with having a simpler career path? But that's not it. Tom sacrificed decades worth of really hard work, not for the respect that comes with having a few letters attached to his name, and not for the paycheck that his work provides, not to impress anyone, and not for personal gain or glory. Tom gave those years to the belief that, like his father before him, he could help others, and that if he could help others, he should. As a fairly introspective person, generally, that realization forced me to look at my own life. How many people around me have sacrificed in ways that benefit me on a daily basis? And in what ways am I sacrificing for the good of others? What am I able to do? And am I doing it? What are you able to do? And are you doing it? In a day when our news stations and social media feeds are filled with stories of people hoarding toilet paper and hand sanitizer and stockpiling protective masks and cases of water to the detriment of others, the reminder that this isn't a complete picture of humanity is such a gift. That we live in a world where people also still give of what is easily their most precious and limited resource, their time, for the good of others. Tom Wynn has done that and continues to do it. And Houston is better because of it. Huge thanks to Tom for the gift that he is to this city and for being a part of this episode. Thanks also to you, as always, for listening and sharing this podcast with others. One part of Tom's story that didn't make it into the episode was about his pursuit early on of a career in the CIA. If you're interested in hearing that story, or if you simply love this show and want to help me make it, please consider partnering with me at the Patreon link in the show notes for this episode. If you're not familiar with Patreon, it's a platform by which you can help fund the work that I'm doing for as little as $1 a month in exchange for all kinds of bonus content from this and other Milieu Media Group podcasts. Thanks so much, friends. I'll be back in 2 weeks with Season 3, Episode 9. This episode of The H was produced and edited by me, Luke Bronner. Our artwork is by the amazing folks at Field of Study. Check them out at fieldofstudy.design. Our theme song is by Robbie C., and other songs featured in this episode were licensed by Blue Dot Sessions. This and every episode of The H is brought to you in part by Pink Cilantro, a social-first digital agency focused on branding, marketing, and all kinds of other great stuff. Visit them online at pinkcilantro.com. Now here's a scene from our next episode.
I was just an intern, part-time. I would go in, he'd let me talk on the radio, we'd do stunts. I'd get to do like all the crazy antics. He would have me do those, send me out in the street to do silly stuff. And it was my first taste of radio. And then I'd done that long enough that he gave me 10 to midnight so I could be on the air 10 to midnight. And maybe that's actually one of the reasons I was pulling that focus away, because I feel like I tapped into something.